Hi, everyone. A 2025 Gallup Walton Family Foundation poll showed that 35% of Gen Z K through 12 students say that they dislike reading, and 43% of those students say that they rarely or never read for enjoyment. The downstream effects of these statistics are potentially staggering, so finding ways to unlock the reading habits of students is of the utmost importance. We'll be talking about that and one school's approach to doing so in today's Teaching Matters podcast.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thank you, Trinity. Joining me today is Juliana Worrell. She is the Chief Schools Officer for Uncommon Schools. Uncommon Schools is one of the highest performing and largest nonprofit network of charter schools in the country, serving more than 20,000 pre-K through 12 students in 52 schools across Newark, Camden, New York City, Boston, and Rochester. Juliana has been with Uncommon Schools for more than 18 years, serving first as a classroom teacher before moving into administrative roles such as principal and now the Chief Schools Officer. Juliana is also the co-author of the book Great Habits, Great Readers, which is a comprehensive guide for K through 4 reading instruction. She is also active in conducting professional development and training opportunities. Juliana, it's great to meet you, and thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I just gave a lengthy introduction of you, but I want to learn more about who you are. So can you kind of talk about sort of what got you into education in the first place, and then maybe also narrate your career as you moved from being a classroom teacher into administration?
For sure. Well, I think that for myself, I always viewed myself in some type of service profession. I was a political science major. I thought I was going to go into law. But as I was graduating college, I decided to explore Teach for America. And I think like most people that joined Teach for America, I thought I was just going to do my two-year commitment and then move on to law school and beyond. But I really fell in love with teaching. I really fell in love with the community that I was placed, which was Newark, New Jersey. And I found myself staying. And over 20 years later, I'm still in education. I did serve as teacher for a number of years before moving into instructional leadership. I had the good fortune of meeting our co-CEO of Uncommon Schools, Julie Jackson, when she was a principal. And I helped her found one of the first elementary schools at Uncommon Schools. And then from there, I went on to lead. I founded Uncommon North Star Academy's third elementary school in Newark, New Jersey. And then I also had the honor of leading Uncommon's first turnaround, where we took over a traditionally struggling school in Newark, New Jersey. And in just 1 year, we was able to achieve really tremendous results for children, in particular for reading. And I think that's what really solidified for me. And I know we'll talk about this topic, but this idea of the love of reading, when students feel successful reading, they tend to do it more. And I found that many of my students that year, because they hadn't started with us, you know, from 5 years old or kindergarten, they were joining us multiple years behind. That was one of my most rewarding years in education. I was a principal at the time, but really seeing students who had traditionally either struggled with reading or were told that reading wasn't for them to find success. And then that success turned into love. And then from there, I went on to be a superintendent within Uncommon Schools. And now I've been in this role for the last 6 years.
So in terms of your current role as Chief Schools Officer, what does that portfolio look like? That's not a title that maybe many people would be as familiar with.
Great question. So I think that what some folks in a traditional district would view as the superintendent or the chancellor is essentially the title that I hold as Chief Schools Officer. So we are in 5 cities across the Northeast, and we have 52 schools, over 20,000 students. And I have a team of regional superintendents of each of those cities that report directly to me. And then I also oversee our teaching and learning side of the house. So that is the side that traditionally delves into curriculum, our overall pedagogical vision, and supports us in ensuring that strong curriculum is being executed, as well as thinking about how we use assessment to figure out where our students are so that we can best serve them.
So Uncommon, as I mentioned in the introduction, is one of the largest school systems in the country. Can you talk about some of the pillars that sort of underpin what it is that Uncommon is trying to do with its students, being a very large nonprofit charter system?
For sure. So I think that when we think about uncommon schools, we are a charter management organization. And I think, you know, when I think about the work that we do, I like to think about first and foremost, our parents having choice in the types of schools that they want for their child. And with the demographic that we serve, that choice doesn't always allow for certain families to exercise that choice given financial constraints or where they live and all of those things. And so Uncommon was really founded to provide strong parent choice on where they want their children to be educated. And then for us, our mission is to ensure that our students receive a high quality, rigorous, joyful education that could rival any top private school in the country. And many of our students are able to not just stay with us kindergarten through 12th grade, but we also support our students well beyond their graduation of 12th grade. We believe that college, and not just attending college, but completing college, will really unlock not only just career and opportunities, but overall financial independence, financial freedom, that empowerment that I think everyone wants for their child, right? For them to be the masters of their own destiny and not allow something like their zip code or circumstances to prevent them from being able to do so.
Yeah, totally. So let's switch to talking about your passion topic. So I'm older than you are, and I remember when I was growing up that I started reading for enjoyment Peanuts books, like the mm-hmm. comic strip in the books, and then progressed into science fiction. And it was sort of that classic, I stay up after I'm supposed to go to bed with a flashlight, you know, reading it. The numbers now are staggering. You know, as I think about the students entering my classroom in higher education, the ones that my daughter is teaching in middle school, the knowledge that they're not reading regularly, at least a large percentage of them, for enjoyment, it starts to get sort of scary because of the potential effects of that. I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. Do you think that there are sort of systemic or typical reasons why students aren't engaging in some of those behaviors that many of us grew up with in terms of reading for fun and to sort of escape, you know, the corporeal world into a world of a book?
You know, thank you for asking that. It's funny because there was a recent study that just came out. It was actually published on the Forbes website that arguably Gen Z, this current generation, is actually reading about 35% more than even our generation, Gen X's, millennials, baby boomers, right? Because they have so much more at their fingertips. And so I think one misnomer is that kids aren't reading. Kids are reading. They're just reading in different ways and platforms of which we were, like you said, taught to read, right? We didn't have social media. We didn't have the internet at our fingertips. And so the question becomes less of why aren't our kids reading? And I think one of the things that I like to think about is how do we ensure that our students can sustain their reading? And so we're also in the age of just, like I said, information at their fingertips, short attention spans. And so one thing that we think about at Uncommon Schools is, one, we're preparing our kids for the world that might not even exist yet, right? The world is rapidly changing and we want to ensure that they have the right skill sets, including being able to be great, great readers. But we also know that getting into a complex text, sustaining that reading over several chapters, several days, does a lot for a child's development, and especially as it pertains to learning new concepts, building their knowledge, in addition to just having that love of diving into that favorite mm-hmm. novel or text. And so I think that in particular, and one of the things that I work on with my team is, what books are we putting in front of students that gets mm-hmm. them excited about reading? I mean, you mentioned the Peanuts, and I immediately had a moment of nostalgia for myself. And my son is also an avid comic book reader, which then progressed, he's 17 now, into mm-hmm. graphic novels, right? And so he actually had dyslexia when he was younger, right? All the studies should show male, black male, dyslexia, shouldn't like reading. Well, why is he not, you know, aligned to that trend? Well, one, maybe I'm his mom. But on top of that, when he was younger, we made sure that he had the skill set to actually mm-hmm. read. And we gave him the knowledge that he needed to unlock the code of reading. And then mm-hmm. we put text in front of him that had his interests, Marvel, like yeah. I said, you know, graphic novels. And he's an avid reader. And ultimately, we want that for all children to be not only successful, but to find that love.
I appreciate the point that you're making about the types of texts that students are reading. As I thought back about, you know, my own experiences growing up, but then also observing a lot of students, you know, as they get into my classrooms, I think reading is a momentum skill, that as you read progressively more challenging texts, your vocabulary expands, your ability to tie ideas together in narrative form starts to expand. And so I kind of view, you know, I'm not an expert on the science of reading like a lot of people are, but I kind of view reading as being a momentum skill, that it builds momentum and you get better and better. And then the opposite is true. If you don't build that momentum and you sort of stagnate, then it can cause you actually in some ways to stop reading and you regress rather than progress. What's your thoughts on that? Do you agree with that statement? And, you know, I guess at the end of the day, I appreciate the point that you make about putting the books in front of the students that they will enjoy reading. How do you go about finding that out, especially with this generation that is pulled in so many different directions?
Yeah, all great questions. And again, things that we grapple with at Uncommon, things that I grapple with as a parent myself. I think that the first thing that comes to mind related to the science of reading is how early we're teaching our students to unlock the code. So if we think back to, you know, traditionally, when do students first learn how to read? And we're thinking about those primary grades. And we're thinking about, especially over the last decade at Uncommon, you know, we've been around, we're getting ready to celebrate our 30th anniversary next year. Science of reading has been a core component since we founded our elementary schools. And when we talk about science reading, speaking more specifically around the direct instruction around phonics, phonemes, you know, being able to string letters together, sounding them out, saying the word with fluency, these things have to be taught. And I think there is for a long time kind of a wave in the country around, well, if you just put a lot of books in front of kids, they'll just pick it up. And we just know that's not true, right? They have to be taught the code. So if we do the right work with teaching them the code and they don't struggle out the gate, it doesn't become something that they hate to do. In fact, they find success and they find that love. Then from there, it's about seeing our students. Who are our students? What are their interests? We like to think about reading as a mirrors and windows phenomenon, right? We need mirrors where they can see themselves in text, their interests, their backgrounds, their culture, and windows. Books should also unlock other cultures, other knowledge-based entities, right, that they may never encounter or won't encounter just yet. And if you strike the balance of that, we are finding that you can hold even a Gen Zer's, right, interest for a more sustained period of time. But it does require us as educators to pay attention. And I think that, you know, we have the books and series that we've loved. We all know in most high school curricula around the country, there's canon text that everyone just reads. And I think we also need to evolve, right? And we need to pay attention to newer authors and newer topics and things that many of our students are facing. And I think both are necessary.
The mirror window metaphor is very powerful. I just love the way you describe that. It's easily relatable to you in terms of, you know, what reading has done for a lot of us. What's your position on screens? I know that there's a significant movement, even here in Southeast Ohio, but across the country, about trying to limit screens in front of students. And I see both sides of this debate, you know, every day. What are your thoughts on this?
Great question. I get this question a lot. I think my thought is probably aligned with many people and what the research is saying is like, you have to be careful. There's some danger in too much screen time. And I think a lot of it has to do with what you named before, right? There's a socialization aspect that's missing if our students are just on the screen all the time, right? If we talk about reading comprehension, for example, we can read a great book, but think about all the times that you read a great book and then had a great discussion with someone about it, right? Whether it be a book club, whether it be a friend, or, you know, those moments are powerful. And that's really when the learning is unlocked. So if students are on a screen for the majority of the day, they're losing the ability to spar with a neighbor, to chat about what they just read, the ideas, back up those ideas with textual evidence, speak intellectually about new concepts that they may have learned. You talked about vocabulary acquisition, test out using that new vocabulary that you just learned. And so again, for all things, I think we're finding that you know, there's a both and, right? There is value with using technology in the classroom, of course. And there's also value to ensure that it doesn't dominate the day. And I think that's how we think about it at Uncommon Schools, especially with the advent of artificial intelligence or a technology-based platforms that are intended to support students in their reading or mathematics per se, but that can't replace the teacher. That can't replace the power of rich discussion and talking about the learning.
Yeah, I think I think back, and there's always the personal moral question of, do I go to the last page of the book to see what happens at the end while I'm reading it? You know, and I'm not as apt to do that if I'm reading something on a Kindle or, you know, an electronic device as I would have been with an actual book in my hand. So you've talked in the big picture sense of trying to figure out how to respond to the students where they're at, give them good opportunities for reading texts that are age appropriate and pushes them. As you actually break that down inside the classroom, if you're one of your K-4 teachers, or then as you get into middle and later grades, what do those strategies actually look like for your staff?
Well, for one, we need to make sure that our teachers are modeling what great reading looks like. And so many of our classrooms, especially our primary grades, you're going to see teachers modeling reading aloud. That can look like the traditional read aloud, students on the carpet with the teacher holding up the book. And in the older grades, it looks like all of the students have a book in front of them, but the teacher is still reading aloud and modeling strong fluency and intonation, depending on the type of text that they have. And so that's a portion of the day. We also have opportunities for direct phonics instruction, and we use a different phonics curriculum to meet the needs of our students. And in the primary grades, that looks like, you know, this is the letter A. This is the sound that letter A makes. Here is the letter A within a consonant, vowel, consonant word. Let's practice sounding it out. And in the older grades, it looks like morphology work. Let's break this word down. Let's look for prefixes, suffixes. What do these root words mean? How can we put that word together? What new word has this unlocked? Then we're also having key components of our classroom, going back to what I named before, related to discussion. So we're going to read text together, and then we're going to talk about it. And as you talk about it, we're going to defend our thinking using evidence from the text. We're going to grapple with the author's point of view and our own point of view. Do we agree with this author? There will be times where we'll have accompany text and allow students to spar with that as well. And then the last component that you would see is an intentionality around writing, which in many ways has become a lost art as we continue to talk about things like screen time and, dare I say it, Claude and ChatGPT.
Yeah.
But our strongest classrooms are able to make a connection between what authors are doing and what that means for you as an individual. Are you inspired by this author's style of writing? Try it out. Do you have your own style of writing? And along with that, of course, what are the grammar and mechanics of it all? And how are we teaching those rules to students as well?
Yeah, I still think there's value in learning to diagram sentences, and there's value in learning to, as you said, understand how words are put together, and the history of those. When in some of the work that I did in researching you specifically and then Uncommon Schools, it's clear that you have you're intentional about describing the type of faculty and staff that you want to be part of your classrooms. When you get faculty in, what are the things that is in your philosophy of how to professionally develop them? And specifically, you know, if you've got faculty members that are in different disciplines, like social studies, for example, where reading is an essential part of it, but yet they're not the reading interventionist, but they still have to be a part of that circle of support for the student. How do you go about doing all that with your faculty?
Such a great question. One, we pride ourselves in our professional development of our staff. I think that may be a bold statement to say, but we're probably best in class when it comes to training teachers and leaders. And many of our teachers come to us as first or second year teachers, some of which don't have educational backgrounds. They went to school for another discipline, and that's okay. We start off, especially for our teachers in our primary grades in our elementary schools, and everyone's a reading teacher. And so we teach them explicitly, what is the science of reading? We dive into the curriculum, we practice lessons with them, and then that development doesn't stop in the summertime when they first join us for in-service. We carry that professional development throughout the year, both through professional development sessions, but then also in one-on-one coaching meetings and what we like to call real-time feedback, where our instructional leaders will come into the classroom and team teach or co-teach or whisper in the teacher's ear, like, hey, ask the question this way, you'll get more students to be able to participate. Mm. And so that development really carries throughout the year. To your question related to the different disciplines, in addition to teaching everyone that what the tenets of the science of reading are, which is strong reading instruction, our social studies and history teachers play a key role in the development of our students' reading abilities as well. In our middle schools, for example, we look at our reading and writing teachers and our history teachers through the lens of just overall humanities. What are just good, strong reading techniques, whether you're reading a novel, a fantasy-based, fictional-based text, or you're reading an informational text that's rooted in the history of this country, primary source texts. One would argue our science teachers need to do the same thing. When you think about subjects like biology, for example, this heavy reading, new concepts, new words. We go back to this idea of morphology, right? You're going to encounter lots of words with rich root words and prefixes and suffixes. And again, even though you're the science teacher, understanding how students develop in their reading is essential in support of them in that vocabulary acquisition, for example. And so all of this is baked into our professional development for our teachers. And then, like I said, we're carrying that professional development throughout the year.
The third leg, the student, the faculty members, and the third leg of that is the families and the parent support. What strategies have you found to be effective to sort of get the parents behind supporting their student in their development as a reader?
We love working with our parents. That can look like, especially in our elementary grades, there's some type of parent communication that happens every single day. Oftentimes, we're not only telling the parents how the students are doing in their reading, we're sending home either small texts or photocopied texts. Hey, your child read this book today in class. Have them read it three more times to you at home. What we're doing there is not only having them practice decoding, but also practicing that strong, fluent reading, especially when there's character development and they can, change their voice and pay attention to dialogue tags, as we tell the elementary students. And we also do this in middle school as well. One of our senior directors of humanities, Steve Chiger, created a AI tool, actually, that where teachers can input a child's reading Lexile level, right, based off of the grade that they're in. So it's sixth grade, the Lexile is X, okay? We are also really diving into the genre of historical fiction. And so using the AI tool to help create or find strong text around that level, along with a letter that gets automated for the families that says, hey, your child is working on X. Here's what they can continue to improve on in their reading, this text with them over the next week, and then time them by the end of the week and see how long it takes them to get through the text. That type of work, if you think of your average middle school teacher, especially in our schools, they may have anywhere from 90 to 100 students. Doing that one-on-one support is a lot to ask, especially for the teachers and how much we ask of them throughout the day. But because that is an AI-generated tool, they're able to do that for all of their students, like within seconds per student. And so we're really able to enhance our parent communication through that process. And that has been a huge win this year in particular.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and certainly one of the benefits of the AI tools that exist, is sort of that personalized and adaptive instruction for students. Because as you know, in a given classroom, especially by the time you get to middle and high, you could have a wide disparity from, a group of 25 to 30 kids in reading levels within the same classroom. And being able to adapt it, I could see that as being an important strategy to keep everybody progressing, whether it's the best reader or students that really need developmental work. I think the last question that I have for you, when I was, again, reading the Gen Z study that I cited at the beginning of the podcast, one of the things that, and you actually mentioned this also just a few moments ago, the gender differences in reading, that's really fascinating to me. Do you want to talk a little bit about, again, you might have hypotheses as to why that is occurring, but how do you sort of think about the need for different strategies for males and females, just given what the differences are in statistics right now?
What we're finding, I mean, there's lots of research out there, right? And one of the key pieces of research that I've read is that developmentally, what age should students even start reading? What are we expecting of them? Some schools of thought is kindergarten is appropriate. Some schools of thought think that kindergarten is way too early. And when we think about biologically the difference between males and females, there's also been talk around developmentally, do males access reading at a later rate than their female counterparts, right? So I've read a lot of these different research-based kind of ideas on why this discrepancy may exist. What we find at Uncommon in our elementary schools is that starting in kindergarten and first and second grade, if we're able to get the students that early and use all the techniques from science of reading, we're seeing our boys access texts at the same rate that our girls are able to. But then something happens as they continue on in their education, especially post-pandemic. We are seeing some of that similar trend, while not as dramatic as the study that you're referring to. We do see that our girl students are also faring better in the humanities, in particular in English and reading subjects. And we have a lot of thoughts about why that might be, but like the rest of the country, again, we haven't been able to zero in on one prevailing idea.
Yeah.
One goes back to this idea of mirrors and windows that I talked to you about before. And what we have found is over the last several years, doing a better job of reaching our males has meant doing a better job of tapping into their interests and making sure that the text that we're putting in front of our students is actually enjoyable for them and making sure that they feel success. And then from there, we think the benefits of having more males in our classrooms as well and making sure that there are more male teachers that are a part of their journey. There's also studies there around the impact of having even just one male teacher in a male's trajectory significantly improves not only their academic outcomes, but their likelihood of attending college, for example. And we're aware of that as well. And so we think about those things and who are we putting in front of our students in addition to the types of texts that we're putting in front as well. But like the rest of the country, you know, we're diving into the research and we want to address it. And that those are some of the ways that we've been doing that.
Yeah, interesting. You have a book, Great Habits, Great Readers. What would listeners learn about if they pick that book up?
They would learn concrete techniques for how to teach kids how to read. The research lets us know that 95% of students should be able to read, but that is not the statistic when we look nationally at how many students are reading on grade level in fourth and eighth grade. So why is that? We want to equip more teachers, educators, even families with the tools of how to teach students how to read at each stage of their reading trajectory, starting in the primary grades, pre-K, kindergarten, all the way through as they enter into high school and beyond. My book, again, starts right with those early years and teaches things like, what does it mean to teach students not only phonics, but what is a character? What is character development? How do authors tend to develop suspense and the different types of reading techniques that students need to be successful, the different types of genres that they need to know in order to tackle text and find out things like main idea and rich themes of the story. And we also provide professional development resources for leaders in educational spaces that want to better train their teachers on how to be more effective in teaching reading, with the goal for all of our students to not only be successful, but to really cultivate that love of reading to make them successful ultimately as adults.
That's great. I'll put a link to the book and the text accompanying the podcast so that people can take a look at it if they would like to do that. Juliana, it's been wonderful getting a chance to meet you. And I just, I love your window and mirror metaphor. I'm going to use that again at some point in the near future, I'm sure. I also love the fact that you're so data driven in trying to understand the science behind how to help your students and your faculty progress. So congratulations on the great work that you've already done, and best of luck as you go forward.
Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate it speaking with you today. And like I said, at the end of the day, we want a great education for all of our students, and we want them all to be avid, great readers.
That's right. My guest today has been Juliana Worrell. She's the Chief Schools Officer for Uncommon Schools. Again, we'll have a link for the book that she authored in the text accompanying the podcast. Thank you. It's been great to meet you. And thanks, everyone, for listening today. A special thanks to April Koska and Trinity Sweet for being associate producers on the podcast. If you have ideas, comments, or suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. That's all one word and all lowercase. We hope everyone has a great day.